Hello and welcome to Volume 77 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll talk about the economic downturn from a couple of perspectives, about how timber investments compare to stocks. We'll talk about how landowners can join together to enhance wildlife opportunities, and how the slowdown in housing is affecting the sawtimber market. We'll also highlight a discovery in the southern pine beetle control. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. One of the debates during these challenging economic times is whether Western-style capitalism is dead. If so, that could have an effect on long-term investments like forests. Our first guest, Dr. Lawrence Reed, has given the topic some thought. Welcome, Larry.
Hey, thank you very much, Hayes.
Does it really matter to a forest owner whether we have socialism on one end of the spectrum or capitalism on the other, or maybe even something in between?
Well, it really does matter. It matters immensely, in fact. If you look at the lessons of the old Soviet Union, of socialism in Eastern Europe, you'll find that those lessons speak very loudly to the fact that what belongs to everybody or nobody in particular tends to fall apart. Government ownership of resources inevitably means that people have great incentive to use and abuse resources, but they have very little direct or immediate incentive to husband them and to grow them. Mm-hmm. But when your personal bottom line is tied to the economic use of a resource, and that's the case under free enterprise or capitalism, you have a powerful reason to be efficient and to care for what you've got and to preserve the capital value of your property.
Why is it then that many people believe that if a resource is privately held, in other words, not held by the government, but privately held, then it's more likely to be abused?
Well, they don't fully understand the broad implications of what they seem to understand in their own personal lives. You know, I wash my own car, I cut my own lawn, I keep my bathroom clean, but I never wash a rental car. I don't keep an eye on the public park down the street, and you'll never find me tending to a public restroom. But some people are caught up in this fantasy notion that when you own something, you become selfish and antisocial, at least other people do, and that if we all own it, we'll live happily ever after. But that ignores human nature. And it ignores what we know about how the political process operates. Politics and government is a world where promises often are made to be broken, and where you've got special interests competing against each other, not so much on their merit, but on who can catch the politician's attention for the moment. And the long term is often no further into the future than the next election.
Bringing this down to a forestry level, is there an inherent conflict between having private forest on one hand and then maintaining and protecting those forests?
No, I don't think so at all. In fact, historically, and just as true in the present day, America's finest long-standing forest land is not just privately managed, it's privately owned. But that's a fact that's just not widely known or understood. Americans were once, I think, more firm believers, I should say, in private property, and still are when it comes to their own personal property. But what we really need is a concerted educational effort long-term to explain how private property works, the importance of individual freedom, responsibility, limited government, civil society. That's what we're trying to do at the Foundation for Economic Education.
All right. Well, thank you, Larry. We appreciate you joining us. We normally discuss the timber market at the end of the program, but in light of what Dr. Reed has said, we wanted to talk to Sarah Baldwin, who recently co-authored an article comparing timber investments to the stock market. Welcome, Sarah.
Hey.
Your article that was in Forest Landowners magazine said that timber fared better than stocks, and you used the third quarter 2008 prices. Is that a fair summary, or do you have anything you wanted to add to what your conclusions were?
Well, I want to add some of the complexity of the problem, and also the results are a little bit different if you're looking at it from the end of the year rather than the third quarter, which was right after, I guess you could call it, the crash. The markets for pine saw timber have fallen, and in the article I think we were saying in the order of 20% over the course of last year, from the end of 2007, to the third quarter, but it was a pretty big chunk of change for some people, as much as $6.50 a ton for pine saw timber. But it was a mixed fall. The pine saw timber and pine chip and saw are very much tied to weak housing markets and depressed building construction, which have been going on for some time, 2 years. So it wasn't really the crash of the stock market that had an effect, but over the course of a 10-year long-term view, we were looking at real high prices for saw timber, pine saw timber, back in 1998,
mm-hmm.
10 years ago. And when we put in biological growth, about 5%, I think, is what we figured on the pine. Pine saw timber did a little bit better than the Dow Jones Industrial Average over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
What really beat out some of the stock investments was the hardwood pulpwood and hardwood saw timber pine pulpwood. And that was a little bit of a surprise to us. I think it's hardwood scarcity. It's not a big, it's not the biggest part of our production from our forest, but apparently it's been gaining in value. So if you were to buy low and sell high, it would have been hardwood pulpwood that would have been your choice.
Okay, and just to clarify, when you factor in the fourth quarter, both stock and timber prices, what's the difference?
It did not affect the results of our 10-year investment
mm-hmm.
exercise. It did, pine saw timber did decrease slightly more and in the fourth quarter, and therefore the decline was 20% rather than 16% over the course of the year.
Was it still better than stocks? In saw timber?
It eked out.
Eked out, yeah.
It didn't do a lot better than stocks, but it did just barely make it above the Dow Jones.
And considering fourth quarter pulpwood, did it do better as well?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Both of the pulpwood products did, 5 to $10,000 better.
Okay.
Doubled your investment if you'd invested in hardwood pulpwood.
Narrowing it down to Alabama, does the situation change at all?
It does. First of all, over the course of the last year, pine saw timber prices actually increased in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that is Alabama has a real strong market. Pine is a very important part of the Alabama market, and Alabama has been trading at a premium to the Southwide average. Unfortunately, what that does with our 10-year investment is that pine saw timber didn't quite eke out a better result than the Dow Jones.
Mm-hmm.
It still beat the S&P.
Okay.
Hardwood pulpwood and pine pulpwood both performed even better than the Southwide average. And that's, again, it's a case of its price appreciation, even though the growth would have been the same, we used the same growth factor as we did Southwide.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks, Sarah. We appreciate that. It's very interesting. Our next guest, Adam Tullis, has found that when landowners voluntarily organize around a common objective, and you could call that a cooperative, they achieve more than if they acted alone, especially in the area of wildlife management. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Hayes. How are you?
What do you think the number one reason that cooperatives succeed and the biggest reason that they fail?
Well, I think the number one reason they succeed is you get multitudes of landowners that can come together. Sometimes it's just two or more, but some instances it can be an entire county if you're talking about a forest initiative. On the wildlife perspective, they come together and they find common ground and they find things that they can work towards. And it helps them feel like they have a better opportunity to meet management goals.
Mm-hmm. You've worked with landowners in Alabama and Mississippi. At what level are the cooperatives really helping to improve the wildlife enterprises that they're operating?
Well, what we've seen is that as these landowners come together and they begin to meet objectives and they start feeling like their goals are getting met, they really are then able to capitalize on revenue potential from these cooperatives. And so the enterprise potential is there, whether you're leasing or whether you're finding an outfitter to lease out to prospective hunters and anglers. The projections look really good, very favorable for those landowners that are willing to do that in the realm of wildlife enterprises, and basically that trickles into revenue production from that property.
Okay. You mentioned the word wildlife enterprises a minute ago. What should folks be thinking about if they're interested in starting a wildlife business on their land?
Well, I call this the ABC steps in my presentations that I give to landowners, and basically it's just identifying the land that's available, you know, whether that's your personal property or whether you're going to have to formulate some type of cooperative to fit enough property together to begin a wildlife enterprise. And then the second thing I feel is important is to identify the wildlife species or fisheries that are going to be of interest, whether that's white-tailed deer production or eastern wild turkey, or whether you have the impoundments available to do a commercial fishing operation. And then the C is recruitment. You've got to go out then once you've established the property and you know what resources are there that will be available. Recruiting hunters seems to be a very easy thing to do, especially, up until maybe this last year, it's been really favorable if you've got the property and the resources.
Okay. Well, thanks, Adam. We appreciate that. Whenever you get a chance to talk to Al Schuler, you always walk away feeling a little bit enlightened about the topics that he's mastered. We wanted to get his thoughts on the housing market and how it might affect sawtimber prices. Welcome back, Al.
Thank you, Hayes.
What's wrong with the housing market?
Okay, good question. The housing market essentially collapsed a couple of years ago due to pretty much easy credit, unrealistic expectations, weak regulation, greed, exotic financial instruments, a whole host of things. And what this did was drive housing prices to essentially unsustainable levels. And at the same time, mortgage prices started going up. And what this did was cause a lot of people to get into trouble with their mortgages, and there were a lot of foreclosures. And house prices collapsed. Essentially, house prices right now are down about 21%. On a national basis from the peak in sometime in 2006. This, by the way, Hayes, is the first time this has happened since the Great Depression, with house prices on a national basis dropping anywhere near that amount. And as a result of all this, banks got into trouble because their mortgages and their mortgage instruments weren't worth nearly as much as what they thought they were. And as a result of this, this got them into problems with their capital ratios. And what they do then, when they get into trouble, is they cut back on spending or on credit. And this caused the credit crisis, basically, which now has spread to the commercial real estate market and autos. Anything, you know, if you buy in this country, you buy it on credit, you can't get credit today. It's very difficult because of this credit crunch. And I think the solution, and then this eventually led to the recession that started in officially December, I guess, of 2007. And I guess for me, I think the solution to all this is somehow we've got to figure out how to slow down the foreclosures. Typically, we have about, even in a good economy, we have about 1 million foreclosures per year. Last year was about 2.25 million. So that has to be, we have to stabilize the housing market.
That's what's happened now. What do you see as the longer-term outlook for housing?
Okay, now this is a more positive thing, but you know, I wanted to mention also what caused the first problem is the subprime market, and those are loans made to people with poor credit FICO scores, less than 620. I just want to mention there's a couple of other exotic mortgage instruments out there that are going to reset over the next 4 years. Alt-A loans and option adjustable rate mortgages. These are loans that are made to so-called people with good credit scores, but Alt-A, there's an interesting twist. These are people that didn't have to have any documentation or no-doc loans. And option adjustable, these are also exotic. And these are going to reset over the next 4 years. The size of this mortgage is 1.5 times the size of the subprime. And so we're not out of this mess yet. But longer term, you mentioned You know, housing is determined primarily, or demand for shelters is determined by three things: demographics, which is net birth rate plus net immigration, vacancy demand, and net removal. And if you look farther out, National Association of Home Builders, they represent the home builders in this country, they're forecasting, if you go towards the end of this decade, about 2 million units per year near the end of the decade. And that's compared with, that's about 10% higher than what the peak was a few years ago. And just by comparison, back in the 70s, it was about 1.7 million. So longer term, it looks really good. And the other thing I wanted to mention, Hayes, is remodeling. A lot of people forget about remodeling, but remodeling to the wood products markets is almost as important as investment in new housing. There's 125 million units out there, average age of about 37 years, and as they get older, we remodel them, we have to maintain them, et cetera. So the remodeling market in terms of investment size, for forecast from the Harvard people, is that's going to be almost as large as the investment that we make in new housing.
Okay.
And that's you know, once we get through the mess we're in right now, it's very, very positive, both from a demographic perspective for new housing plus remodeling demand. And remodeling is just as important to the softwood people and hardwood people. It's even more important.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that. Thank you for that. We appreciate it, Al. The southern pine beetle causes enormous losses to forest owners, and it's often thought the only way to control that is just by doing salvage operations to minimize loss. But it turns out the southern pine beetle needs something called symbiotic fungi to succeed, and that's the discovery of Dr. Chetan Usir, who works at Mississippi State University. Welcome, Dr. Usir.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us about this discovery?
Hey, these beetles are amazing. Yeah, but we are after them. We've been asking why they are so successful at infesting and killing these valuable trees. To answer this question, we've been looking into their lifestyle and living environment. We know that female beetles are heavily dependent on a particular fungus species as food source. These female beetles have collar-like patches around their necks in which they culture these nutritious fungi, and then they inoculate the spores of these fungi in beetle galleries. Then they lay their eggs, eggs hatch, and larvae feed on these nutritious fungi. Until recently, we didn't know how these beetles protect their fungal food source from other detrimental microorganisms, such as a blue stain fungus. We discovered that they use a bacterial species with a strong antibiotic secretion. So, in a sense, these beetles use this antibiotic as herbicide to weed out these other fungus species.
And so the beetles themselves are trying to protect this fungi, and what we'd like to do is interrupt that cycle?
Yes. What we can do now is look into their life cycle, interrupt their life cycle. So we can target these useful the interaction between these newly discovered bacteria and beetles,
mm-hmm.
We can look at how this newly discovered antibiotic works at inhibiting fungus growth, so that this could be modified to target other fungus species.
Looking ahead, how would the follow-up discoveries one day translate into applications that could actually control the southern pine beetle?
Again, we can go ahead and just look into this particular antibiotic, how it works to inhibit mm-hmm. the fungus. If we can find this, then this could be applicable to these beneficial fungus species.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Usir. We're interested in that discovery. We appreciate you sharing it with us today. The Clean Water Act was designed by Congress to require permits for certain activities, but forest harvesting is exempt from getting a specific permit from the government as long as you have an ongoing silvicultural operation. What is an ongoing silvicultural operation is something that Frank Green has been monitoring. Hello, Frank.
Hello there, Ace. How are you doing this morning?
We understand in Georgia there is a case involving silvicultural operation that could have some implications. Can you tell us about it?
This is correct. I guess not only are we facing tough times economically, but some of the environmental groups now are challenging exactly what you mentioned. What is the definition of normal, established, ongoing operations that is expressly listed in the Clean Water Act? So what I guess the case is has kind of picked up steam from a case going on in Louisiana involving cypress harvesting in jurisdictional wetlands. We had a case in Georgia where some of the environmental groups were challenging, you know, that language, and it went to court. The court sided with the environmental groups that this operation was not ongoing and really could affect how timber is sold and managed in the, you know, in the whole Southeast. What was core to the case on this particular one around the Statesboro area, it was a kind of a mixed Tupelo cypress tract back up in some drainage areas from a pond. The landowner wanted to harvest the trees. He had a consultant do a plan, a harvest plan, and, you know, this is what they were going to do. They were going to follow BMPs and so forth. And, you know, it got challenged by this environmental group. And what is, I guess, key to this in the way that timber is sold on the market is not only the judge recommending that you have a harvest plan, but you need, or that landowner or consultant forester needs to go back and look at past silvicultural activities. Just because you may have harvested a tract and there's stumps out there, this judge ruled that that does not constitute previous silviculture.
So they seem to have a premium on having a plan, probably a written plan, and also looking at the historical context of that particular forest, whether there was harvesting in the past or not.
Exactly, and really key to it is not, I mean, they're focusing on past regeneration. And
now, what do you, do with a cutover cypress stand?
Exactly. I mean, that was the point, you know, with hardwood management, including cypress, it's kind of passive management. So this judge ruled that in the plan that whoever wrote, whether it be a consulting forester or a state forester, they needed to go back and show proof how these trees were established, you know, 80 years ago.
Okay.
And, you know, it was a result of natural regeneration, coppice sprouting, and how this, the trees were managed, you know, how fire was kept out of the area or these bottomland hardwood areas to show that it's ongoing silviculture. And then, you know, once the tract is harvested, how the, you know, if it's mat logging or how that's going to be carried out, and then how the trees will be regenerated. So all that is going to be imperative we see in some of these bottomland cypress areas.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Frank. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. We appreciate it. Andy Whitaker is editor of Wildlife Trends, and he's familiar with what plants are preferred by wildlife. Hello, Andy.
Good morning, Hayes. How are you doing?
Non-native invasive species, that's a word that is scary to a lot of landowners, and maybe for good reason, but you suggested that there are some plant species that are non-native and potentially invasive, but they're still useful to wildlife managers. Could you tell us about some of them?
Sure. I guess what started all this, we did an article in the magazine last year on building what we called a honeysuckle exclosure. In other words, planting honeysuckle and building a fence tent over it so that the plant can grow and then the deer, other animals, can eat what comes outside of the fence and not kill the plant, because as most landowners would tell you, you look in any around any trees and the honeysuckle's eaten up to death up to the about head high for deer. So they're eating it up quite a bit. We're just trying to produce, producing planting items that are good for the deer. Honeysuckle is very good in protein for the deer for antler growth, for instance. The up underneath the exclosure would be good hiding places for rabbits and those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I did get some flack about that because it is we talked about planting Japanese honeysuckle,
mm-hmm.
and it's not native, obviously.
That's not native. Anything that's Japanese is native, right?
Right.
Okay.
But at the same time, I guess my bottom line is you have to manage whatever you do plant or whatever you do grow.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of management techniques could you use to keep it from being invasive, which is a bad thing?
Right. Well, for instance, in the case of bicolor lesbadeza, a lot of quail managers like to plant that. Burning, mowing, making sure it's planted in the right soils. It's not going to be as invasive in sandy soils as it would be in clay soils. So herbicide use is very important as well. Obviously, we're not promoting Kogan grass or kudzu. Those are the real problems and a lot of good folks are doing a lot of work on that. But certain things, again, for instance, sawtooth oaks are not native. But you go to most nurseries, wildlife nurseries, they're selling a stew of them.
Okay. Well, Andy, we appreciate that. Thanks for that clarification on that. This interview takes place on the day after the inauguration of Barack Obama as president. In addition, there are some changes in Congress that require some analysis of the topics that concern forest landowners. Clint Bentz is a CPA in Oregon and has some ideas to share. Hello, Clint.
Hello.
What's going to happen with the estate tax with the Democratic-controlled Congress and an Obama administration?
Well, as you know, the estate tax has been in flux ever since 2001 when the Bush administration changed the law and worked for a gradual repeal of the estate tax. So we've been on a glide path to have the estate tax repealed effective next year in 2010. However, that repeal was only going to be in effect for 1 year, and then for budget purposes, they didn't want to make the repeal permanent, and so we were going to go back to the old tax law that was in effect before 2001. The Congress has been in just a death match on the estate tax since this time. The House has voted three times for a permanent repeal. It has not been able to get through the Senate. And what's happened is the Obama, when he came into office and before, he just gave a speech last week where he basically wants to freeze the estate tax where it is right now. So in 2009, we have the ability to pass $3.5 million tax-free to our heirs, mm-hmm. and with anything over that having a flat rate of 45%. And so he said that that's where he wants it to stay. And my guess and all the commentators that I'm listening to right now are saying that's, in fact, probably what's going to happen and that we'll get some certainty to the tax code. One of the big problems as a planner right now is, you know, doing estate planning, you know, our clients are saying, what should we do? And the short answer has been, well, you tell me when you're going to die and I'll tell you what you should do.
Let me ask that. Al Shuler mentioned the housing market and the depressed values for real estate and so forth. Do you see any planning opportunities?
There's some huge planning opportunities. You know, as you know, timber prices and the value of our logs are way down. And one of the primary reasons for that is that new housing starts are down 72% over the last 2 years. And so January of 2006, on an annual basis, we had 2.2 million new housing starts. This last month, it was 625,000 new housing starts. So it's down, like I said, almost over two-thirds. As a result of that, the values of our properties have declined. Now, a lot of the land values haven't declined. In some markets they have, but the value of the timber has. And so that really gives us an opportunity right now to think about transferring these properties to the next generation through sale or through gifting, just taking advantage of these lower values. Another opportunity that's available for us right now is something that we call the 75-20 rate. This is the rate that the IRS requires us to use, the interest rate that they require us to use when we're figuring out discounting and long-term plans. And so this rate in February is going to be 2% is the rate that we have to use to discount cash flows, which means that we set up a charitable lead trust, a grantor retained trust, the several more exotic estate planning opportunities. These things work really, really, really well right now because we only have to earn more money than this. As long as our investment is earning more than this 2% rate of return, all that additional growth is, in addition to the growth of the property, is going into the estates of our children rather than ours. So we have a great opportunity right now to move assets at a depressed value to our children using a range of tools. So this is a great time to do some planning, even if you're not out cutting timber right now.
Okay. Thanks, Clint. We appreciate it. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Lawrence Reed, Sarah Baldwin, Adam Tullos, and Al Schuller. And we also appreciate the contributions of Chetan Usir, Frank Green, Andy Whitaker, and Clint Bentz. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.